Good evening, and welcome to American Conservative Party Radio. My name is Tracy.
And I'm Bill.
And we are going to get down into the depths of conservatism. Get ready. Bill.
Hey, good evening, Tracy. You know, the only bad thing about the time today that we do this show, we are just going to go off the air when the polls close in California.
Well, what's your feel?
They're going down, except for one E or F, whichever the one is that says that the elected officials can't get a raise if the budget
while
isn't
there's
balanced.
No budget.
Yeah. Yep. Everything
well,
else.
Well, I understood that you were interested in just putting them all down just because it made it easier for people.
I said that on Twitter for sure. In regards to a question that somebody said, "Gosh, are we really against that one?" And the fact is, it's just easier to say vote no on all of them. That way there's no confusion. Gosh, let's see. Did they tell me to vote no against 1A or yes for 1A? And, you know, it's just easier to say get rid of them all.
And I don't see the big deal. You know, it's not actually going to solve anything.
No.
If, you know, the millionaires don't get, you know, their 2% raise this year.
Exactly. The other thing is, there's already law on the books in California that they aren't supposed to get their expenses and all that kind of stuff until they pass a budget, and that just every year goes by the wayside. So it's like, why have another one that they ignore?
Oh, but we are so good at making laws that everybody ignores.
Aren't we? We are. If there was a gold medal for that, we'd have it.
Well, I did notice that in today's Barack Obama announcing of the new CAFE standards, he had three governors. He had Schwarzenegger, he had Michigan's governor, whatever her name is.
Granholm,
and
I think.
What was the third one? There was a third one.
There was, and I don't remember the name.
Anyway, they noted that their approval ratings for those three governors were like 25, 26, and 27.
Yep, something close to that. And they all of them have disastrous deficits in their state budgets.
All right. In the course of human events, or in this case, Twitter, I had a discussion with numerous people over the last several weeks on what is conservative. There's a whole lot of argument going on in the GOP, in the conservative movement, per se, with this idea, first of all, that the GOP has gone too moderate. Rush has been pretty harping on this pretty extremely, that we got a moderate presidential candidate in the GOP this last time around, and how did that work for us?
Right.
Well, there's certainly something to be said about the idea that John McCain was a moderate. He certainly wasn't a conservative.
That's true.
So, the GOP apparently has set upon itself the idea that the problem with John McCain was Sarah Palin. That
okay.
If it hadn't been for Sarah Palin, John McCain would have won. I'm sorry, that's the only way I could take it, because apparently the GOP believes that John McCain was almost moderate enough, except for that he got this stupid conservative vice president.
Right.
If he had actually gotten a moderate vice president, then he would have been moderate enough for everyone to have elected him.
I see.
Course, that
fantasies are always fun, but,
fantasies are interesting. You know, conservatives and the GOP have always argued that they are the party of reality. Well, I don't know what reality that is, but it certainly isn't the one that had played out last fall.
No, that sure isn't.
The only reason John McCain actually appeared to be competitive in November was because Sarah Palin was on the ticket.
Absolutely. I mean, just look at the number of people that they drew to their rallies when they were not together. I'm really telling there, I think.
So the argument has now the GOP has suggested that the conservative base has moved too far to the right. They are too strident, too fixated in their ways, specifically on social issues, to appeal to a much broader, a much bigger tent that the Republican Party believes it needs to appeal to in order to survive against the big boat that is the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that argument.
And I think it's a load of
hey.
However, the conservatives, I believe, especially those that are being called strident and too far to the right, are equally wrong in suggesting that a moderate position is exactly the worst thing that the GOP can be doing. Let me clarify. Because everybody's going to suggest that I'm interested in a moderate position. And nothing could be further from the truth. I have been called a libertarian. I have been called an anarchist. And on a rare occasion, somebody has considered me to be a conservative. But more recently, I've been called an Uncle Tom, a house lesbian whore. You know, come on, people.
Really? God. My observation is this. When people start calling names, that's the exact moment when they realize that they've lost the argument.
Well, I would suggest to people that I'm willing to have an argument if they're even willing to start. Forget, but the name calling starts way before we even get started.
Mm-hmm.
So there can't even be a discussion about, some premises to work off of.
Yeah.
But the reason I'm suggesting that the conservatives that are complaining about the GOP's call for moderation are wrong is not because the GOP is calling for moderation. It is. But because the conservatives think that certain positions that they hold are, in fact, conservative positions. And I'm willing to argue they are not. And
okay.
If they were willing to actually hold conservative positions, they would probably satisfy the GOP without any requirement to be moderates. But in order to understand how I have reached this drastic conclusion that the moderates are wrong for calling the far right too far right and the far right is wrong for calling the moderates too moderate, I need to clarify what I mean by conservative. Because apparently, today, in this country, we lack a basic understanding of what the hell the word means.
Yes, we do.
And when I said something yesterday, a person on Twitter said, "Hey, you need to be more detailed about this." And, of course, Twitter gives us 140 characters. And
yeah,
and
right.
140 characters is not going to cut it too well.
Yeah.
And this is what I said. Social conservatives are classical conservatives. Classical liberals equal conservatives today. Now, let me define clearly what I mean by classical conservative. Classical conservative believes that knowledge is based on centuries of traditions and customs. That morality is a tradition constituted not of natural or human rights, and that government functions to preserve order. That is a classical conservative position. Let me speak to a classical liberal position. Oh, Tracy, come on. What did you do with it? Classical liberal is classical liberals tend to have a basic view of rights and the role of government that Jefferson and his contemporaries had. Classical liberalism is the belief in liberty. One of the clearest statements of this philosophy is found in Jefferson's Declaration of Independence. By the way, I'm taking this out of an essay written by John Goodman, who is president of the National Center for Policy Analysis. And what is classical liberalism? At the time, as the case today, most people believe that rights came from government. People thought they only had such rights as government elected to give them. But following Locke, Jefferson argued the other way around. People have rights apart from government as part of their nature. So, the general idea is that a classical liberal believes in individual liberty. The individual is sovereign. Whereas a classical conservative has a general belief that society, the stability of society, is more important than individual liberty. Let me focus in on two conservative thinkers that have been extensively talked about on the conservative side over the last year and a half that I have been actively involved in discussions about conservatism. The first is Edmund Burke, probably considered the father of conservatism. People call it Burkean conservatism. It is this idea that his formulation of what conservatism was based upon I can't say this in an easy way. All right. Burke stated in the most basic form that society had a right to call upon the individual to give up their in order to ensure the stability of the institutions of the state. People are really going to have a problem with that.
They are.
Let me quote a few things from Burke. An election for kings would be utterly destructive of the unity, peace, and tranquility of this nation. He argued at the time, this was around 1790, that at the time of the French Revolution, that individuals did not have the right to elect their king. That, in fact, that was not their ability to do so. And he argued that the rights proceeded from the king rather than from the individuals. Therefore, individuals could not elect a king, because then the king would be abdicating his right to the individuals, and that's something he was absolutely opposed to. He argued that at one point in time, individuals may have had that right when, in fact, England had no successor king. But the people abdicated that right. As a matter of fact, they said, "In the name of the people, most humbly and faithfully, submit themselves, their heirs, and posterities forever to the king. If the right to elect the king existed, it was renounced then forever." And the time was 1688. I don't know about you, but Bill?
Yeah?
I love my parents.
Oh, yeah?
They certainly cannot bind me to obligations they made 40 years ago.
That's absolutely right.
And they're alive.
They still can't. They can give you that look, but they can't make you do it.
That's right. And the idea that their great-great-grandparents could bind me today to some oath is ridiculous. But Burke believed in that. Burke claimed and asserted that our liberties as entailed inheritance derived from our forefathers. And I think that that was just nuts. I quote him from Reflections on the Revolution in France. "By adhering in this manner and on these principles to our forefathers, we are guided not by the superstition of antiquarians, but by the spirit of philosophical analogy. In this choice of inheritance, we have given our frame of polity the image of a relation in blood, binding up the constitution of our country with our dearest domestic ties, adopting our fundamental laws into the bosom of our family affections, keeping inseparable and cherishing with the warmth of all their combined and mutually reflected charities of our state, our hearths, our sepulchres, and our altars." Burke believed that traditional institutions were of paramount importance: family, church, government. That those institutions had the duty to pass on the moral, traditional moral teachings that made moral people. And that because we were a corrupted being, because we were sinful in our nature, because we would do things that were irrational. I tend to be irrational every once in a while. Yeah. Because we tend to irrational behavior, we need guidance. We need strictures. We need rules from traditional authorities. Family, mom and dad telling us to do what we're supposed to do. Church, the bully pulpit. Actually, the pulpit. Not the bully pulpit. You know, and government, the bully pulpit. Government telling us what we can do in order for society to enjoy stability. This is what drives me crazy. The idea that stability is more important than disruption. Now, I'm not all for destruction and disruption. You know, in a helter-skelter kind of way. And I use that phrase specifically.
Uh-huh.
But I am for the idea that if you have a society that is stable, you have a society that is stagnant.
Yes.
It doesn't grow. It doesn't change. It doesn't evolve. And when you have that situation, you know, you have self-destruction going on. It may be peaceful. It may be polite. But it is dead. Or
yes.
Soon to be dead. And this is the thing that Burke, his traditional conservative, hits home, and I alluded to it earlier. Compliance with traditional morality is more important than individual liberty. It is here, on this sentence, that the social conservatives die. Because the individual is sovereign means that the individual can make choices that oppose traditional morality. They are not stability stabilizing for society. They are destabilizing society. People make choices that we don't like. And this country is founded on the principle that you and I get to make those decisions based on our pursuit of happiness, not what you think that pursuit of happiness should be. Burke disagreed with that concept vehemently. He believed that stability is of the utmost importance, stability of the state, and the society are inseparable. Think about that. It is more important that society and the state maintain the status quo than my individual liberty. If that's true, the state and society can dictate anything to me.
Yes.
In the name of maintaining stability.
Yep. Which has all, which has been, at least in our centuries, the late 1800s through the 1900s, has always been the clarion call of the dictator.
It's the clarion call of Barack Obama.
It is.
We need to bring stability to our financial markets. Therefore, we are going to spend $700 billion and take over companies so that we can bring stability to our financial markets.
It is also George Bush who said, I had to kill the free market in order to save it.
Yeah.
Excuse me. It was, I think it was Alexis de Tocqueville that said, and I'm paraphrasing, that Americans have an ability to continually reinvent themselves. One does
and
not
should.
Reinvent oneself without examining where you came from and saying, we like this part of it, we don't like this part of it. So we're going to go over here and we're going to do this.
Well, I'm going to answer somebody right now.
Uh-huh.
No, it wasn't a super success. TK, it wasn't.
Uh-oh.
French Revolution degenerated itself into, you know, a nightmare. And I'm not going to get into why it did so. We can leave that for another particular day. But
Uh-oh.
The reason it did, Burke's solution to the French Revolution was to reinstitute the monarchy and just fix it.
Mm-hmm. Without electing anybody.
Barack Obama's making exactly the same argument.
Mm-hmm.
That he can fix it. He can fix the economy. He can fix the government. Well, you know, a little revolution every now and then doesn't hurt.
I think Thomas Jefferson observed that.
So, Burke, being the father, led to, amongst a whole lot of other things, Russell Kirk, who has been actually a pretty formidable force in the conservative movement
mm-hmm.
the latter half of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And many people have, you know, pointed me to his 10 Principles of Conservatism.
Right.
And I have a few issues with them that we're not going to get into too much tonight, because, you know, if you're interested, I have a long post about it on the American Conservative Party.org website under conservatism. Actually, my take on Kirk's 10 conservative principles. Now, I want people to understand that I'm not throwing you under the bus, social conservatives. I'm not. But I want you to understand where I'm coming from when I suggest that, in fact, social conservatives are classical conservatives, not classical liberals. Kirk developed 6 general principles, 6 what were called canons of conservatism. And I'm not really worried about a whole lot of them. But one of them is kind of important. And it's the last one. A recognition that innovation must be tied to existing traditions and customs, which entails a respect for the political value of prudence. I've taken that to mean that Kirk is of the idea that disruptive inventions, disruptive technologies, should be restricted when they disrupt or injure traditions or customs. Now, this country has a long history of innovation across a broad spectrum of places. And the idea that something, and he never suggests, at least to the extent that I've been able to find at this point, what it is that should restrict innovation in such a way that it doesn't disrupt traditions or customs. I would suggest that allowing the wife to work outside of the home was disruptive to traditions and customs. But I don't know of many conservatives that believe that the wife should be locked in the house with the kids 20 hours a day. There are some, I understand that, that actually do believe that. And there are some that believe that that is, in fact, where we belong. Nah, nobody in their right mind says that, right?
No, I'm actually, no, I don't think they do. I think that's a bugaboo.
As a bugaboo. I think, Brian? Anyways, one of the things somebody wrote, his name was Tiber Machen.
Tracy, before we get off of that particular passage, I would simply say that I think that Kirk, when he says there needs to be a respect for it, is not saying that there needs to be a blind obedience to it. I'm just saying that I believe Kirk was saying, before you change this, think it through. Think about it. You don't blindly change it. You don't change it just to change it. You respect it, and you say, okay, I looked at that. I like it. I don't like it for these reasons. I think it needs to go this direction from that point. But it isn't a willy-nilly, oh, that's old, throw it away. It also isn't, oh, no, we can't go there because this is the way we've always done it.
Well, now, many people have suggested to me that change for change's sake should not be the goal of anybody. And I've argued that, let's see if I can pick a situation that is not loaded with all kinds of
baggage. With all kinds of baggage.
Let us say, here's a good one, okay? Let us say that I have determined that I can increase the fuel efficiency of cars from 35 miles to gallon to 110 miles to the gallon,
mm-hmm.
provided I do two things. My innovation requires a slight change to the way engines operate, and it requires that the steering wheel be moved to the other side of the car.
Okay.
Okay. Now, I would suggest to you that that would be a pretty disruptive invention in this country.
Really?
On more than a few levels.
Really?
Yeah, I think, first of all, a car that can get 110 miles to the gallon, that would be a problem for some places. But also, for those of us that have never driven, in England, driving on the right side of the car versus the left side of the car is probably something that they would have a hard time getting used to.
You know, Tracy, show me that vehicle at 110 miles to the gallon. Demonstrate to me that it, in fact, works that way in the real world. I'm there in a heartbeat. I'm sorry. Let's see. Do I want to pay at $3 a gallon for fuel, do I want to go 110 miles or do I want to go 35 miles? Oh, gosh, tough choice there. I don't know.
But let's say that I simply mandated that everybody had to change their cars over.
Oh, now you got my backup. I'm sorry.
Okay. Here's the point that I want to make, is that it's not change for change's sake.
Exactly.
It's change for a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And many of the changes that people suggest we need to step back a moment, consider the consequences, are in fact change with a purpose. Now, it may not be a purpose that people agree with. It may not be a purpose that people feel comfortable with. It may even be for a purpose that people disagree with. But it is seldom, and I would argue never, change just for the sake of change. So while I think I understand your point that Kirk wants us to respect the consequences of our act and to consider them with their bigger implications in society as a whole, I'm not suggesting that a whole lot of people woke up this morning and said, yeah, I think I'm just going to do it, just for the hell of it. In most cases, individual choices were seriously contemplated, consequences seriously considered, and in the end, that was their decision. So I'm not willing to concede the idea that anybody is arguing change for change's sake on any of the topics that are most commonly being used to bring up that particular point. Not willing to concede it. I believe that change is done because people have sought the change, have considered the implications, have considered the consequences, not just to the change. This might be something that I think you, Bill, recognize, but maybe others don't. There are consequences to change. Yes, we understand that. But there are also consequences to not change. And those consequences sometimes can be as extreme or detrimental as consequences for change. and those are sometimes misapplied also. From the Heritage Foundation, somebody was writing about Russell Kirk and his opinion about liberalism.
Tracy, can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you fine.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I don't know whether my phone was cutting out or not, but I wanted to bring up a point.
Go ahead.
And that is, those folks who are proponents of changing need to do two things.
No, we
they
don't.
Need to make their case.
Okay.
And they need to persuade. The third thing that they have to do, and I know I said there were only two, but there are three. The third thing that they have to do is to seriously take in consideration the objections that are raised to that change. It's one of the things that I love about this country, and that is we can have those discussions without people bringing out the knives and the guns, and we can do that in a respectful manner. And at some point, there are either enough proponents for that change that that change happens on its own within the populace, not by judicial or legislative decree, but because people are convinced that, yes, that's a change we need to make. And enough of them are convinced that that change is de facto made.
Gosh, that sounded awful reasonable.
I'm sorry. I'll try and be a little more strident next time.
And completely... Nah.
Yeah, I'm thinking not.
You know, it sounds like a perfectly reasonable point of view, okay, that I should be able to sit down with you or anybody else and say, hey, this is what I'm considering doing. This is a change that I want to do. I understand it's going to have some consequences upon your own lives. In the sense that it's going to be disruptive to your worldview, but based on my opinion, it's not going to have much of an impact on your specific liberties or freedoms, and therefore I want to proceed with that. Now, I would like your opinion about that particular point of view and how you think whether that change is good or bad, and then you're going to sit there and say, well, I think it's bad. It does disrupt my worldview, and, you know, it creates a problem for me as far as how I live my life, and if you go ahead with that, it's going to be disruptive to me personally and to us as a society. And I sit there and go, you know, I understand that, but in the end, you know, I have to be true to myself, and, you know, I have to take into consideration, you know, my own personal liberty and my own pursuit of happiness, and that's what I'm going to do. And then, and this doesn't apply to you because I know better, a lot of people that have the point of view that you have espoused say, over my dead body.
Actually, I don't, the folks that I know don't say over my dead body. What they say is, you cannot do that. If you want to do that for yourself, that's fine. What you can't do is judicially or legislatively require that.
And then I have my problems.
I understand.
Because, as a general rule, this country doesn't necessarily do what is right by popular demand.
That's true.
The slaves were not freed because... You know,
popular
the polls
demand.
Had 53% of the people going, good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Civil rights were not granted because 68% of the people went, yeah, we're idiots. Let's do this. In general, historically speaking, this country has had to be dragged kicking and screaming to do things that we today... go, duh, of course, that's the right thing to have done. But at the time, the majority was not interested in doing it. And often it was done by judicial demands. Now, by judicial demands, I don't mean judicial legislation, which is the argument that you're making.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, part of the argument, but yeah.
This week we're going to get a really good example, apparently, somewhere in the next 2 days, 3 days. We're going to find out exactly how much judicial activism occurs when the Supreme Court in California rules whether Prop 8, in fact, was constitutional or not as far as the California Constitution is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Whether a majority can, in fact, override what the Supreme Court of California said was an individual liberty.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have argued that I have not seen in California or in Iowa judicial activism. Haven't seen
it. Well, we here in California would disagree with that, but that's okay.
Oh, I certainly understand that.
Yeah.
And I'm not an attorney.
No,
okay?
Me either.
I do play one on TV every once in a while.
Yep.
And occasionally
and
on
I
phone.
Slept in a Motel 6 or whatever it is.
Yeah. Holiday.
Yeah, there it is. That's the one.
And because I've worked for an attorney for the last 10 years doesn't give me any particular beneficial point of view over anybody else's point of view. But my point of view is, based on a reading of the entire opinion, that in fact it was simply, you know, the judge is going, this is the way the Constitution in California reads.
Mm-hmm.
And in its most simple form, California had created a civil union path for same-sex couples, and it had provided for a marriage path for heterosexual couples.
Mm-hmm.
And that the two paths were essentially identical. One was called civil unions, one was called marriage, one was for gay partners, one was for heterosexual partners, but they were, in fact, exactly the same process. And the California Supreme Court said, separate but equal is unconstitutional. That's how they read it. That's how they said it. And, of course, California, rightly so, put it on the ballot and voted about it.
Mm-hmm.
So the question will become to the Supreme Court, can a majority infringe upon a right that the Supreme Court has said actually exists? We'll find out.
Yep.
And it'll be interesting because if the Supreme Court rules that Prop 8 stands, then the people on the right will cheer that result, even though it is exactly the same court that they complained of judicial activism about 6 months ago. Actually, it's a little bit more than that. It was about 10 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
If it rules against Prop 8, then it will, in fact, be judicial activism from the right.
Yep.
It's too often when a judge rules and you lose, it's judicial activism. When a judge rules and you win, it was justice.
I agree. I mean, you and I are not in disagreement on that.
One of the things that I want to go back to what Tibber said about Kirk. Because he was talking about culture, saying that all culture arises out of religion. In my definition of religion, he's right. But in the definition most people hold of religion, he's wrong.
Yeah, I guess my problem is he used the word all.
All culture, is a pretty strong thing. And of course.
Yeah.
You know, you have to understand what he means by religion, okay? And, you know, when I look at religion, I look at there's two components that make up religion. There is the deity-worshipping portion, and then there is the moral and ethical training portion. Now, for people in the religion, there is no there is no distinction between the two. I understand that. But one is how it faces the people inside the religion,
mm-hmm.
and the other is how it faces the people outside of the religion.
Yes.
And so those distinctions, you know, it depends on what he was trying to actually say in there. His issue on conservatives of the day, and this was in the mid-50s, was he had read Ayn Rand and found her point of view to be compelling as opposed to a more traditional conservative point of view. And he distilled it down to this idea that Ayn Rand had confidence in the human individual.
Yes.
And that conservatives lacked that confidence. As a matter of fact, Kirk went on to go to great lengths to make the point that at the heart of human beings, we're corrupt, we're sinful, that we shouldn't be trusted as individuals to behave in, you know, good ways. Now, this is actually something that I've been saying for a really long time, and it had nothing to do with conservatism or liberalism. It had to do with how I managed people as a manager in the different jobs that I've had. In every position that I had the opportunity to do so, I scrapped employee handbooks. Took them and threw them away.
Mm-hmm.
Because in most cases, employee handbooks are rules to keep the children in line. And if you're going to treat your employees as children, there is every likelihood that they are going to act like children.
Like children, yep. You get what you expect.
If you are going to treat adults as adults, then you're going to lay out a certain set of, you know, criteria. This is our goals. This is how we're going to do it. And let them do it as adults. You're likely not to have a whole lot of problems. Now, everyone understands that there's the odd moron, the odd idiot, the odd person that is willing to abuse every privilege and every responsibility to get away with blind murder and stealing if they can do so. I'm not talking about the average moron. I'm talking about the average adult. And Ayn Rand had the general idea that at some point humanity has to grow up.
Yes.
We have to become adults. And there was every indication that the American Revolution suggested that humanity was coming out of its childhood. That, in fact, it could be trusted to act like adults. And that acting like adults meant that they could make their own decisions. That they could have the freedom and liberty to do what they wanted without everybody deciding whether it was right or wrong. That is, in my opinion, exactly what our country is based on. That the individual is sovereign, that the individual has reached the point where they are adult enough to be able to make their own decisions. Now, there's a whole lot of people. In my opinion, 5,987,000,000
yeah,
morons that are well ensconced in the 13-year-old point of view. That there are a lot fewer adults walking around today than I would certainly like to hope.
I don't disagree.
But, does that mean that the adults have to be treated like children? And that's kind of where I'm at. I don't want to be treated like a child anymore.
Okay.
Now, liberals like to hold out that they are, in fact, the standard bearers of the classical liberals. Wrong.
Nah.
Because if, in fact, individual liberty is the fundamental foundation of classical liberalism, then there are rights and responsibilities associated with that individual, his sovereign concept.
Yes, there are.
If you are sovereign and you have the freedom to act in the pursuit of your happiness, you are limited only by the consequences of your acts infringing upon my liberty and freedom to pursue my happiness.
Well, no, you have more consequences than that.
Well, I'm going to suggest to you that we could spend another couple of hours discussing
consequences
of that.
Yeah, I know.
Okay. There is a limit to your ability to do whatever you damn well please.
Yep.
It's called my nose. Actually, I don't like that phrase a whole lot.
No.
Because the consequences of your actions extend only as far as your reach. I could be standing 10 feet away, and your consequences don't really belong 10 feet away from you. They don't even belong 8 feet away from you. They belong about as far as you can reach. So even
okay.
if I'm not anywhere near you at the time. However, what somebody suggested that I don't have, I don't have the right to take your life. Yeah, that's correct. I don't have the right to take your life. That's the key. I don't have the right to call upon you to give me anything.
Yep.
I can have the right to free speech. I cannot demand you listen to it.
That's true.
I can have the right to own property as long as I don't demand you give me yours so that I have it.
That's true. All things which Ayn Rand said, by the way.
I'm going to read, again from John Goodman, president of the National Center for Policy Analysis. It is worth noting that all forms of collectivism in the 20th century rejected this classical notion of rights, and all asserted in their own way that need is a claim. For the communists, the needs of the class were a claim against every individual. For the Nazis, the needs of the race were a claim. For the fascists, and for the architects of the welfare state, the needs of society as a whole are a claim against the individual. Since all of these systems, the state is the personification of the class, race, or society, all of these ideologies imply that, to one degree or another, individuals have an obligation to live for the state. Now, I want you to replace state with church, or with tradition.
I don't think you can go that far.
Maybe. Carrying on, despite the fact that 20th century collectivists oppose the classical liberal concept of rights, very rarely did they attack the notion of rights as such. Instead, they often tried to redefine the concept of right in a way that virtually eviscerated any meaningful notion of liberty. For example, in his 1944 State of the Union address, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt called for a second Bill of Rights. Does this sound familiar?
Oh, yeah. We know anybody else who's done that?
Which included the following. The right to a useful and remunerative job in the industries or shops or farms or mines of the nation. The right to earn enough to provide adequate food, clothing, and recreation. The right of every farmer to raise and sell his products at a return which will give him and his family a decent living. The right of every family to a decent home. The right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health. The right to adequate protection from economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment. the right to a good education. If this sounds familiar, President Barack Obama is all for this particular
second Bill of Rights.
Bill of Rights.
Yes.
A Bill of Rights that absolutely demands from me that which is mine for your benefit.
Yes.
Hello?
Mm-hmm.
That is a classical conservative point of view. That, in fact, it is the society, it is the state that needs to be preserved at all costs to the individual.
Mm-hmm.
So, with 3 minutes left.
Yes.
Not too shabby.
Not bad at all.
I would suggest to you that those that call themselves social conservatives, and I realize that there's a lot of my friends among those people, you are, in fact, what I would consider to be classical conservatives. The idea that the individual can supersede traditional morality is just something that seems to be beyond your ability to agree to. And I understand that. But the classical liberal position is that the individual is sovereign. The individual liberties supersede the state. They precede the state. The state is a function of my liberties. It is not the giver of my liberties.
And there you have the conundrum. Because those so-cons would say, marriage is my word. It is my union. And it is dictated by my church. You do not have a right to co-opt that.
And I would suggest to you that any action that I can conceive that I have the ability to perform, the ability to actually do, and the resources to which to call upon, sufficient that they do not interfere with your personal liberty, I may take that action at any time.
And in fact, my belief is so-cons will agree with that statement. The statement that they won't agree with is, and you know what? You can't get the judiciary or the legislatures to tell us that that isn't our institution. And that is the conundrum.
And I understand that. However, the government doesn't belong to one, or even a group, or even the majority. It's a servant of all of us.
Apparently it's not a servant of all of us.
Oh, well. You're gonna get pickings and suggest to me that those classical conservatives, those that we call liberals today, feel that they are outside of the reach.
Dang, we ran out of time.
Well,
no?
I would suggest to you that we could probably continue this on other times.
Yep.
But I think we've gotten enough to go that if people want to have a debate, a discussion on the Conservative Party website, that I'd be willing to jump into it.
Me too. You bet.
There's a lot
say the
on
website.
There already.
Say the website.
AmericanConservativeParty.org. That's the old side of the web of the organization that has the debate functions. Bill, thank you.
Bill, thank you, Tracy. It's been good as always.
We'll
shout out to my CT buddies.
We're off.
Hey, cool. All right. Tracy, you're going to need to refine that argument a little bit.
Well, yeah, you know, okay, which part?
Well, the last part that we were talking about, which is if the individual is sovereign, then the government can, in fact, not tell you what your mores and morals are going to be. And this goes beyond, a little bit beyond what we have agreed on, that, wait a second, these are states' issues, they aren't Fed issues. And that is that if government cannot tell you what your mores and morals are, then it cannot dictate any specific form of those mores and morals.
Well, that's right. I believe that the government cannot dictate those morals.
And yet that's what we're asking them to do.
Well, I would suggest to you that that was the position that we have put it in by allowing it to be involved in things that it didn't belong in the beginning.
In the first place.
Right.
Ah, there's them damn unintended consequences again.
You know, think about it this way. You know, if the government had only continued to recognize common law. Now, I got married under common law in California.
Mm-hmm.
In the old-fashioned way.
Ah, okay.
We did what we were supposed to do. We lived together for 7 years, for 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went to friends and family and said, we're married. And then we went to a minister, a justice of the peace, and said, we're married.
Mm-hmm.
And that justice of the peace issued a private marriage license.
Right.
Which was then taken to the state government and registered.
Mm-hmm.
No blood tests, no involvement of the state. You know, it was a registration. Now, California is one of only two states that still does that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh. Wasn't aware of that.
And there's only common law in 9 states. I think it's 9. It might be 6.
Hmm.
Wisconsin is one of them. You still have to get a divorce the same way as everyone else does. And in fact, my divorce was final on the 4th anniversary of my marriage.
Is that right? Oh, jeez.
Yep. 4 years to the day.
Oh, man.
I've always told people I've made 2 brilliant decisions in my life. One was getting married, the other one was getting divorced.
Very good.
And they were not mutually exclusive.
No, they are.
At the time, they were exactly the right decisions.
They're separated in time. Absolutely.
In any case, as long as government is in the business of recognizing a contractual right, then it has to do so in a way that's non-discriminatory.
And Tracy, I don't disagree with that. The only thing that I'm saying is marriage is a sacrament, not a contractual right.
Right. And therefore, if somebody walks down to the justice of the peace and gets hitched, by the justice of the peace.
Right. Okay? Civil ceremony. Right.
They are not married by your definition.
Well, they may be, quote, married, but that marriage is a different thing than that church sacrament.
Right, and I'm a firm believer in the general idea that the church should be able to bestow its sacrament on whoever it damn well pleases and withhold it from whoever it damn well pleases.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
and it should have no legal consequences.
Nah, I don't think I'm going there.
All right. We'll talk about it some more.
Okay.
I got two dogs itching, and
you better take care of them.
A partner that said that she wanted to take a shower as soon as I was done.
Okay. Time to go take care of family stuff.
Family stuff. Bill,
you betcha. All righty. You too, Terry. Bye.